When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Celtic State of Mind. I'm Paul John Dykes, and today I'm delighted again to be joined by Kevin Graham for the regular series Scream of Celica. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hiya there, Paul. How are you getting on?
I'm very well. I'm just looking forward to the next instalment of music and football memories based around a particular LP that had an impact on you back in 1996, it is tonight. So tell us, what album have you chosen from 1996?
The album that I've chosen this week is Suede with Coming Up, which was released on the 2nd of September 1996. Now, this album was probably an album that anybody who was a avid Suede watcher wouldn't have thought it was going to get made after Bernard Butler departed in 1994 during the making of Dogma and Star, and when Suede themselves decided to replace Bernard Butler with a 17-year-old guitarist called Richard Oakes, who turned out to be quite a child prodigy on the guitar. So when this album came out, there wasn't really too much hope for it, and looking back, I think a lot of the press were hoping that the band were going to basically fall on their faces, eh? But it turned out to be their best-selling album ever, and it produced 5 top 10 singles, which was a record at the time. It's a bit of a departure from Dogma and Star, which is one of my favourite albums. For the want of a better word, Coming Up is a flippant pop album. It's shiny, it's a bit glam. Basically, the band went to try to write 10 hit singles and to reinvent themselves, basically, as a band. Because basically, they became a different band when Bernard Butler left. Richard Oakes joined, and a keyboard player, Neil Codling, joined as well. So they went from a 4-piece to a 5-piece. Lost one of the songwriting partnerships, and they just went for a different tact, a different take on an album. The album's heavily influenced by Bowie. They've always had a Bowie influence, right enough. The album's heavily influenced by Bowie and T-Rex, you can hear that. And it was introduced to the world by a song that's been heard in numerous jukebox and numerous indie discos up and down the land, and Trash, which I remember hearing for the first time and going, what's that? That's completely different. When I say completely different, it's completely different and the same as what Suede always sounded like. if you get what I mean there.
I do get what you mean, because I think that's the beauty of Brett Anderson. It was unmistakably Brett Anderson, but obviously the band had gone through a kind of facelift. And this was a band, Kevin, who I was a big fan of the first two albums. I really was. And a big part of that, I guess, was the kind of lead singles, the top singles from each album. Animal Nitrate, what I loved about that was the visuals in the actual video and the front cover of the single. When you used to have a single with a front cover, I don't even know if they've got artwork these days, you know, but back then the front cover was a work of art. It was part of the story. And there was a big influence, a big Stanley Kubrick influence on the video and the artwork. If you watch it, there's loads of references to The Shining, and you might not have noticed it, Kevin, so definitely check out the video for Animal Nitrate on YouTube. And one of the most obvious references, as well as the masks and that kind of stuff that's going on in that video, it's quite a creepy, dark video, is, you know, the famous carpet in the Overlook Hotel that wee Danny rides his tricycle down, you know, and,
yeah,
and it's got the funky 1970s design, the pattern on it, kind of orange, yes, and brown.
Yes.
That carpet, believe it or not, that carpet can be seen in the video to Animal Nitrate. So keep your eyes peeled for that. And another one, which is quite strange, another reference, just going completely off topic, another Shining reference is in Toy Story, the original Toy Story. And when they're in the house, you know the boy next door, what's his name, Sid?
Sid, uh-huh.
When they're in his house, he's got the Shining carpet as well. So that carpet pops up from time to time in the most obscure of places. But I loved that Stanley Kubrick influence on the Animal Nitrate video. And I thought it was a great song as well. But some of these bands, Kevin, that come away with a huge single, and I'm thinking back to Radiohead with Creep, it almost becomes an undoing a lot of the time. I know that Radiohead refused to play that song for a long, long time, Creep. Animal Nitrate almost became Suede's trademark, didn't it, for a long, long time. And I think the second album, which commercially didn't do as well as the first one, was a superb record. And the single The Wild Ones on that is just a beautiful record. And I think it stands the test of time as well, doesn't it?
Definitely. And it's one of those albums that's always, when you get the music magazines, when they say the top 100 albums, British albums ever, Dogman Star is always going to be in there. It's an absolutely sprawling record, ambitious record, and but also there's tension in it, and you can tell that there was tension when they were recording it. Funnily enough, that you should mention the artwork. All the artwork for Coming Up was done by Peter Saville, and yeah, I don't know if Peter had a hand in the early Suede sleeves. I've need to double check that, but I know for a fact that he done all the artwork for Coming Up and the singles. So the influence that they took for Coming Up was a German artist called Paul Uberest.
There was a distinct change. There was a distinct change in the actual image of the band, and a big part of that was the artwork. I think Suede, with their videos, some of the lyrical content in the first couple of albums could be quite dark. I thought Suede could be quite a dark band. And then when the third album came out, Kevin, I just felt it was pop. It was very polished. And the artwork played a part in that, because every single was very stylistic. And it doesn't surprise me that Saville was involved in that. Famous, of course, for his work with Factory Records, wasn't he?
Definitely. That's where everybody remembers him. And it was the recent documentary that was on the TV about Suede. I didn't realise Peter Saville had done the artwork. And then when they interviewed Peter Saville about it, I'm going, why did I no notice that was Peter Saville? Because it's got his, when it's pointed out to you, you can see it's got his style about
his
it.
His style, his trademark. Yeah, I mean, the other band that springs to mind, I know that he's worked with a few bands, the other one that springs to mind, Kevin, is Gay Dad. Remember Gay Dad?
Unfortunately, I do, aye.
Terrible band, but their artwork was always good. And that was another collaboration that Saville had around about that time. When was Gay Dad? Was that about 1998? That was a couple of years later, wasn't it?
I think so, aye.
Easy to forget, to be fair. One final reference and mention of Kubrick and The Shining. Don't know if you've ever seen it, Kevin, but there's a documentary called Room 237. And it's about the big conspiracy, about the hidden meaning and all the hidden messages, all the subliminal messages that are hidden within The Shining. And it's intriguing. Whether or not it's true, who knows? But it's very, very, it's a good watch, and I would recommend that. But you mentioned there about Bernard Butler. I always remember the comment that was made by Noel Gallagher when he was asked about Bernard Butler leaving the band, and he said, it's about time. There was always this feeling that Butler was going to go away and have a phenomenal solo career, but I felt that his solo work was pretty underwhelming when he left Suede. What was your thoughts on Bernard Butler coming away and doing his solo work? This is prior to the work that he did with David McAlmont and stuff like that. I thought it was pretty underwhelming.
To tell you the truth, the only really solo stuff that sticks in my mind with Bernard Butler is the songs that he done with David McAlmont, and also when he got back with Brett for The Tears, which would have been 2010. I know that he's quite a sought-after producer, and he's produced quite a lot of records. So I wouldn't really say solo stuff came onto my radar at any point, really, or made... I mean, I loved, obviously, the big hit single that you had with David McAlmont, Yes. What a fantastic soul record that is. But anything else didn't really capture my imagination or that. And I think that was the same when the band were about to... when Suede were about to release Coming Up in 1996... I didn't really hold out much hope for it. And strangely enough, you mentioned there that it was a pop album. It is a pop album, but my favourite songs on it are the slower songs and the ones that have got the sort of more darkish lyrics, like By the Sea, Picnic by the Motorway, the Chemistry Between Us and Saturday Night. I find they're absolutely fantastic songs, and better than all the... for me, they're better than all the singles. I can take or leave... I like the singles. The singles are really, really good. But what for me, what makes that album special is the slower songs on the album, which is quite weird, considering it's seen as quite a pop album and quite a danceable album, quite a commercial album, that I like the darker songs better on it.
Yeah, it's definitely an upbeat album. Often is the case though, Kevin, that when you invest your time into an album over a number of years, often in the background the singles come out, become big hits, they get loads of radio and airplay, and it's difficult because the singles can almost become wallpaper. It's hard to appreciate them. I remember, you know, going back to an album that just about everybody had, What's the Story, Morning Glory. And I remember the very first time I listened to that and hearing Wonderwall. And there was something special about that, because you could never listen to it like that ever again, Kevin, because the song became so big, so popular, that do you even listen to it properly now when you hear it? You know what I mean? So the actual beauty of the song has kind of been ruined over time because it's been so played, and it will continue to be. And that's because it's a great song. But even in me saying that, there'll be people cringing going, ah, it's rotten. But it's not. It's a great song. But it's just been played so often that it's difficult to appreciate it as much as you did that kind of first time you heard it on record. And that happens a lot with big singles on albums as well. And then you appreciate the non-single, the album tracks a wee bit more.
Definitely. On Twitter recently, Dave Scott, our kid, was talking about Morning Glory, and I couldn't tell you the last time I listened to Morning Glory, because it's in my mind, and as you say, it's probably overplayed in my mind, and the initial emotional reaction that I had of that summer playing it all the time, I'll never get that back. And it's one of those albums that I don't need to hear again. And it was good to revisit this album for obviously this podcast, because I never bought this album when it came out. And how it got into my psyche was, you heard the singles everywhere. It didn't matter where you went. You heard Trash, you heard Lazy, you heard The Beautiful Ones. Pub jukeboxes were blaring them out. Radio 1 was blaring it out. Any houses that I went to before or after nights out, these songs would get played. And I didn't own the album for a good couple of years. And also at that point, I was working away a lot at that time in Oban, and we used to go to the pubs most nights, and it didn't matter, you could walk into any pub in Oban and it would guarantee you would hear Trash before shutting time. Somebody would put Trash on the jukebox and it wouldn't be me. So it was one of those albums that made a massive crossover. I checked when we're doing this, I think it sold 500,000 copies in Britain, which right, is a phenomenal amount of units sales now. But it wasn't until later, as I said, that the slower songs started seeping into my psyche, and they gave the album a lot more depth than I thought it actually did have based on the singles. And you mentioned before, I love Brett Anderson as a lyricist. He's very poetic, he conjures up great imagery, and he's also quite clever with a lot of his song titles. What he tries to suggest in songs, what you think he's suggesting, can mean two different things. One of the songs on this album is The Chemistry Between Us, and I think the chorus goes, "Class A and Class B is the only thing between you and me." So right away people will think that's a drug reference, but I'm thinking that's not a drug reference. That could be upper class, lower class, working class. There's another take on that. So I always liked Brett as a lyricist, very poetic with what he tries to conjure up. And right from the start, you mentioned the early singles there. He has been like that, and even now, I must admit, since they reformed in 2011, I think, and the three albums that they've done since they've reformed, every one of them's been utterly fantastic, and possibly their last album, The Blue Hour, could be their second best album ever, I think, anyway.
It's an interesting discussion that we've had before, Kevin, whereby you get into a particular album or a particular band for a period. So the last time we had this discussion, I mentioned Idlewild and said I was into them for three albums, and it was the same with Suede, to be fair. The first three albums, I was, you know, listening to them regularly, buying the singles, as you did back then, because bands used to produce good B-sides, so it was worth actually buying a single, even if you had the album. But then after that, my interest waned, and I've never bought any of their last five, but we're now at a stage, and it's your belief that a lot of these bands who...
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Sold a lot of units maybe back in the 90s, and a lot of them are kind of self-producing, self-publishing. They're releasing their own records on their own terms, and it's your belief that they're now producing some of the best work of their careers, and I find that really interesting. And it may well be that a lot of it's going under the radar because they're not, you know, coming to your attention with a big hit single, with a flashy video and that kind of thing. But we're kind of going back to that word of mouth ethic, and social media plays a big part in that. The song that we championed just the other week there by Children of the State, I share it on WhatsApp, the 18 or 19 people on WhatsApp then start talking about it, and it just spreads. And it's kind of going back to the way music used to be, but in a kind of digital age. So I think that's great. But you'll need to recommend some of the later Suede stuff to me, because I kind of did lose interest after album number three and moved elsewhere. But one last word on Bernard Butler. I did really enjoy the material that he produced with McCallman, David McCallman, who had that great gospel voice.
He had a fantastic voice.
Oh, I mean, that single, yes, is a standalone song. It's just pretty unique in many ways.
You still hear that now and it stops you in your tracks.
I couldn't imagine anybody trying it on karaoke.
Oh, no, that chorus... When he belts out that chorus, it stops you dead, and you've got to listen. Oh, fantastic single. And they maybe set the bar far too high with that song. I think I listened to that, or I heard that, nearly every weekend that summer it came out.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And they did have, I mean, they released three albums together, two of them.
Three albums,
yeah.
There you go.
So again, just through this discussion, it's easy enough to go and listen to these kinds of things. I would certainly recommend the first two. I've no listened to the third one, but I was maybe critical of Butler's solo material, but as you said, he now collaborates with a number of different people, produces a lot of records, and one thing that he did was a standalone single with Edwyn Collins, and it's not heard that often, and I remember it being released, and it definitely had a video, but I can't find the video online, but the song was called Message for Jojo. So it was a one-off single, no album that I'm aware of. Somebody might want to correct me, but it's just brilliant. It's a collaboration between Bernard Butler and Edwyn Collins, and you can find it on YouTube, but you can't find the video. It's an audio only, and I would recommend that as well. This particular album, as I say, was the final album that I kind of invested in with regards to Suede. I love the Bowie influence because I'm a big Bowie or Bowie fan myself, but around about that time as well, Kevin, there was other things happening in 1996. There was huge cultural changes occurring. And one of the big coming-of-age movies for a lot of people was Trainspotting. Tell me about your relationship, not only with the film, but with the book. How did you become aware of Trainspotting, Irvine Welsh, and thereafter the film? It had a huge impact on me as a teenager.
Probably like a lot of people round about that time. Obviously, he started seeing his name appearing in the music press and stuff like that. And I remember my cousin Gary bought the book, and it was sitting in his house. We used to be around his house quite a lot round about that time. And there was the cover with the guys on it with the skeleton masks. And I'm going, what's that? And he's going, oh, it's a great book. It's a fantastic book. You should read it. You should read it. And then when I realised it was probably making a crossover, as I spoke to somebody in the local pub that I'd drunk in at that point, and who wasn't into music, he was an older guy, and he went, you read that book, Trainspotting, it's absolutely fantastic. So I think I borrowed it from my cousin and read it, and it was the first book I'd definitely read since I'd left school, and I couldn't put it down. It was a portal into a world that you maybe weren't involved in, but you knew. Every Scottish scheme was like that. Every Scottish working class town had elements of Trainspotting in it. Maybe no the hard drug side, but there was stuff that was discussed in that you knew happened in your wee Fife village, my wee Stirlingshire village. You knew it spoke to anybody of a certain age in Scotland. And I went, wow, that's fantastic.
Groundbreaking. It was groundbreaking at the time, wasn't it?
Definitely. And Irvine Welsh has inspired a generation of creative types round about my age. And he's created a genre. Obviously, his genre comes from himself. Welsh will say that he's influenced by like the Beat Writers and Hubert Shelby Jr. by Last Exit from Brooklyn. But to do that in a Scottish voice, to do that with the attitude that he'd done it with, which was him and Kev Williamson doing Rebel Inc. as well. Yeah. They just didn't give him. They were there to smash the literary establishment in London. And that's what they did. And Welsh done what he set. I don't think he set out to do. All he did was set out to write a book. But it's definitely changed the world of literature, and it opened literature up to a whole generation that would maybe have not been interested in books. Obviously, when you hear that they're going to do the film and Danny Boyle's involved in the film, your mind starts thinking, how are they going to make this into a film? Because it's wee short stories that shoot off like two bob fireworks in all different directions. And I remember I went to see the film on a Monday night in the old cinema in Stirling, and there wasn't many people there. I think it must have been out for about a month by this point. And I remember watching it and being disappointed that they had missed out certain sections of the book. Yeah. So I had to go back and see it the following night, because once I had got the book out my system, I had to go judge it as a film. And that's when I realised, by the way, this is a work of genius. Right away it became our Quadrophenia. Right away it became our Clockwork Orange. You knew it was iconic. You knew it was going to be the zeitgeist of people our age group, because it had cool music. It was absolutely fabulously filmed, and it was grey, it was dark, it was gritty, it was funny as anything. And would you get a better last scene than Mark Renton stealing off his pals and walking across, is it London Bridge? I don't know if it's London Bridge, one of the bridges in London anyway, with Born Slippy. banging in the background. You go, what a fantastic movie. It was an adrenaline shot. You actually walked out of that film buzzing. I've lost count how many times I've seen it. Any time it's on, I'll watch it. It was the same way, obviously, they made Trainspotting 2, and that was based on the book Porno. Yep. And again, that was one of these films where I'd done exactly the same as what I'd done with the first Trainspotting. I went and watched it and walked out disappointed that there was certain elements of Porno not in it. I was disappointed, spoiler alert here for anybody that's seen it, I was disappointed at the sort of happy ending. But I went back and watched it again, and it was never going to be able to capture the essence of the original. But it's a decent bit of cinema. It's a decent picture. The lads in it do the characters really, really well. That's one thing as well, when you go back to the first one, when somebody told me that Hamish Macbeth was going to be Begbie, I was like, what?
I know. I mean, see, the thing going back to the book, first of all, obviously that was published a few years before. It was published back in 93. And it was the silver and black front cover that I remember. And with a lot of these things, just like what you mentioned there, Kevin, you know, you can't profess to be the person that goes out and discovers these things. Somebody passes you the book. It's lying in your house. It belongs to your big sister, in my case. Or, you know, it was the same with the Stone Roses records. They were always written about my house because my brother and sister were a few years older than me, so they were discovering bands of the time, of the era, of their kind of generation, if you like. So you were able to nab the records and then later on thank them for giving you the gift of the Stone Roses and that type of thing. And it was the same with Trainspotting. The book was lying about, and I always remember the quote in the front actually from Rebel Inc, and it was, "Deserves to sell more copies than the Bible."
That was Kevin Williamson that says that, aye.
Aye, well, that's worth reading, you know, so you read it. But then, you know, when you hear about the film, like yourself, I thought to myself, how on earth are they going to tackle this? Because it was such a vast body of work in one book. And then you've then got to watch the film on its own merits. I remember, I think it was somebody in the film who said that virtually every scene could be a movie poster. It was filmed so well, you know, every scene, you know, with Renton crawling out the bog or whatever, you know, the Renton and Diane standing outside the volcano and all that kind of stuff. It's like every scene could be that poster, every scene could be a front cover. It was so stylish. The soundtrack was very much of its time. I think people probably didn't. Now, listen, I'm not saying people didn't know who Iggy Pop was, but people of a certain generation probably didn't know that much about Iggy Pop, right? The younger generation who were getting into Trainspotting probably started listening to Iggy Pop as a result of it. So it was very influential. Not my favourite Irvine Welsh book. So I was going to ask you, what is your favourite Irvine Welsh
book? I've got to be obvious, and I will say Trainspotting, but I must admit, I really did enjoy one of his latest ones. I really did enjoy The Blade Artist.
The Marabou Stort Nightmares, that's my favourite Irvine Welsh book overall, without a doubt. I just, you know, there must be a time when someone adapts that into a movie. But there are some other superb books written by Irvine Welsh, and one of my kind of left field favourites, I guess, is Glue. I think Glue is unbelievable. I love the way that these characters come and go into all the different stories. The Blade Artist that you mentioned, what I liked about that was stepping back into Begbie's youth, you know, talking about his old man down the docks and all that. That was really quite dark, and it showed you a kind of insight into his makeup. But we all know a Begbie, we all know a Spud, you know. And this is the thing.
Oh, definitely. That's what I was probably meaning earlier on when I says, even though you know many of us, I couldn't relate to the hard drug use, but I could relate to the characters. And as you say, everybody knew somebody like Rent, and everybody knew somebody like Spud. Everybody, every wee village that left Bradford, Scotland, has got a Begbie. It's quite weird, eh, because Mark Renton is a sort of anti-hero. He doesn't set out to be the hero, but for me, he always end up feeling quite sorry for him, even though he's maybe not on the face of it as devious as Sick Boy, but he's still as devious when push comes to shove.
That's right. And it goes on and on. I mean, obviously, there have been so many books since then. I take your point about the amount of people he's influenced. I actually think that he's got more copycat writers than anybody else on the planet. And it's quite obvious early doors. Being influenced is one thing, Kevin, but trying to replicate some of these styles another, and I don't think anybody should ever try and do that, you know, because if you read Irvine Welsh, you wouldn't say, he might be influenced by the Beat Generation, but you wouldn't say he writes like Kerouac or Ginsberg, you know, you wouldn't actually say that, but they've influenced him enough to start writing, perhaps, you know. But in the meantime, I think It was frustrating around about that time with all this great art happening around about us, Kevin. It was actually frustrating in many ways for Celtic supporters because we had gone through that, you know, that terrible time of getting rid of the old guards and Fergus coming in, the year at Hampden, returning back to paradise, and then bringing in the quality, eventually being able to invest in the squad and bringing in the quality. But then the actual season itself, 1996-97, was just tinged with disappointment when you look back. I mean, superb talent on show. You had Tommy Burns, the man in charge. I still regard him as my favourite Celtic manager. My favourite Celtic manager. I'm not saying he was the best, but he's my favourite Celtic manager. And you know, we had the three amigos, we had McStay, we had Stubbsy coming for big money, yet it didn't happen in Tommy Burns' last season. Talk to us about your memories of 96-97 in relation to Celtic.
It's quite, as you say, that there's a bit of opposites going on here, eh? It's 96, you've got Trainspotting, you've got Euro 96 as well, which was a big, massive tournament which captured Scotland qualified. We had England in the group. We played them on a Saturday afternoon at Wembley, and it was a great summer. The tail end of the previous season, we had a great side. We had a good side. Not a great side, we had a good side. George Cadet looked like he was going to be a fantastic signing for us, and he was going to score the goals that would turn the 11 draws that we had the previous season into wins. In the summer, we signed Alan Stubbs for what was then our club record fee, and you thought, well, that's the defence, a better centre half there. I know that you interviewed Big Yogi the other night there. I'm sure Big Yogi would admit that he was a journeyman centre half, and we needed another bit of quality in there. We lost John Collins, which is always going to be a blow, losing one of the greatest Scottish midfield players ever. And Fergus fought tooth and nail to try and get some compensation for that. And then we signed De Canio as well. So you're thinking Cadet was almost, I'm going to use the old football cliche here, eh? Cadet was almost like a new sign-in because he had signed that, well, he was cleared that late in the previous season.
Yeah.
And we had signed De Canio, who was 28-year-old. I'd played for a few big clubs in Italy. And you went, this could be it. This could be us. And also you had Van Hooydonk there, eh? And you're going, well, let's see, the pressure was on us. It really was on us. And I think when you look back, I think Tommy, even at the start of that season, his sort of demeanour changed as he knew what he was facing in the coming season. And the opening game of the season, Van Hooydonk scored a cracking free kick and Stubbs promptly got sent off and we went 2-1 down against Aberdeen, and Andreas Thom had to score an injury time for us to draw 2-2. I was at Pittodrie that day, and you walked out of Pittodrie. Rangers had been so dominant for that long. I walked out of Pittodrie that day going, Jesus Christ, we've lost the league already on the first day of the season. It was just the way that was that season, eh? It was pressurised all the way through, and there were some great moments. De Canio's league debut at Rugby Park on a horrendous weather day when we were 1-0 down again. Gordon Marshall let the ball go through his legs, and Cadet ran the show in the second half.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
De Canio scored his first goal. Cadet scored one. And Andreas Thom scored the third, I think. But at that point, Van Hooydonk was getting dropped because he wasn't signing a new contract. He was unhappy at getting offered £7,000 a week. And he would still be the third highest paid player at the club, but he was behind Andy Thom, was the highest paid player at the club at that time. So it was a tough season, a real tough season. We're also going into that season as well, and we hadn't beaten Rangers for 7-8 games, and this was probably going to turn out to be Tommy's downfall. And we never beat Rangers apart from the Scottish Cup tie that season. We lost all four league games to them. And I don't know if you remember them. They were all extremely bad-tempered affairs. We had chances in a lot of them. Obviously, you've got the cadet chopped off goal at Ibrox, and we eventually lost the two late Eric Bo Anderson goals that day. We lost 1-0 at Celtic Park in the November, again, when we dominated against them. Then one of the worst ones was the one later on that season when we lost 1-0 at Celtic Park again, and they had brung back the 105-year-old Mark Haitley for QPR, who just basically bullied us off the park. We just didn't seem to be able to stand up to that team, that Rangers team. They just seemed to have the hex over us. And see, looking back, I had to make sure my mind wasn't playing tricks on me here. We bet them in the Scottish Cup tie.
And we bet them well, that's the thing. We were 2-0 up after 20 minutes. We beat them really well that
night. For me, I think the reason that we bet them well that night was because we scored the first goal. And looking back over any other games, the games that we played well, I really do believe if we had scored first, there would have been completely different stories. So I had to watch it back, because the Canyon only lasted 45 minutes that night because he got kicked off the park. And I really did think, my memory told me, that Paolo Di Canio was unplayable for that 45 minutes. A couple of days ago, I was thinking to myself, I'm going to really need to check that. So I found the highlights on YouTube, and he was unplayable for that 45 minutes. They couldn't handle him and Cadet. They couldn't handle... Tosh McKinley had a fantastic game. He was just shelling balls up front, and Cadet and Di Canio were causing havoc in that Rangers defence. What really caught my eye about watching the highlights, though, was... first couple of minutes, Craig Moore tried to break Tosh McKinley's leg with a horrific challenge, which went unpunished. We got a free kick, but the challenge actually went unpunished. And I was having a look at that Rangers team, and it's probably one of the last Rangers teams I can say I really, really know that I like them, but this team, they were dislikable for number one right through to number 10. Loudrop was all right. We could get a lot away with Loudrop. He was a fantastic player. But that night at Celtic Park, they had Alec Cleland, Gordon Petrick, Craig Moore, Davy Robertson and Alan McLaren, Ian Ferguson in the midfield, a pass at Paul Gascoigne in the midfield, and Eric Bo Anderson up front. And I'm having a look at this side, Paul, and going, that is a... maybe it's just my mind playing tricks on me, but having a look at that side, the names now, that's a terrible Rangers side.
I know, but it's going back to what you said there. They had this hold over Celtic, and in many ways, that's what undone Tommy Burns. Tommy Burns was undone by the fact that he couldn't get that hold back over Rangers. And in that season, when we beat them 2-0 and we beat them well, you kind of thought to yourself that that might have been the monkey off your back. But, you know, it came down really to the Rangers' defeats. And there were various other poor results that season, a wee bit of upheaval. But even then, Kevin, I was still surprised when Tommy got sacked, even though the result itself against Falkirk was dreadful. And I'm going to tell you a wee story about that game. Also, one that is very interesting about George Cadet. Now, this interview I done with John Hughes the other night, a couple of things came out of it which was really interesting. Didn't have a time really to dig in a lot of the time because there was questions coming in all the time, Kevin. It was a live Facebook event. So he mentioned something, but he couldn't really dig in and get under the floorboards with it. He just had to move on to the next question. But he said that when Celtic signed him, Tommy Burns done the deal without the permission of Fergus McCann. Found that very interesting. But it showed you the kind of relationship that Tommy Burns may have had from the early days, really, with Fergus McCann. And there was another thing that Hughes said about Di Canio, and he said that Di Canio played for himself. So although he showed this passion, and when he was interviewed, he came across as showing passion, etc., Hughes was of the opinion that Paolo Di Canio, as gifted as he was, he played for Paolo Di Canio. And if you've got that kind of influence within the dressing room or on the training pitch, then that is going to filter through as well. And often when things weren't going well, Di Canio kind of lost the plot. And he did that famously against Rangers, where he was threatening to snap Ian Ferguson, etc.
He done it against Hearts as well. We equalised against Hearts, and he got sent off before the game restarted for having a fight with Gilles Rousset in the Hearts goal in the net, and he shouted at the referee, and he was shouting at the Hearts players on the way back to the halfway line as well. I remember that sending off at Celtic Park. And obviously I remember I'm losing the plot in the Rangers game as well. Going back to that, when I've had a look back over this season, I asked myself the question, if you would have been able to keep one, either De Canio or Cadet, who would you have kept?
Well, I would have kept Cadet.
I'm the same. I would have kept Cadet as well.
I've got a wee story about Cadet, which I'm going to share with you in a second. But when we talk about that game where we beat Rangers 2-0, I think the problem was that we thereafter went on a run of games where Kilmarnock beat us 2-0, Rangers beat us 1-0. We draw with Dunfermline at East End Park. We draw with Raith Rovers at Starks Park. We then draw with Falkirk in the Cup. It goes through a replay. And although we beat Aberdeen in the league, we come back for the replay and Falkirk beat us. So it was a dreadful, dreadful run of results. In the meantime, we buy Tommy Johnston for £2.5 million, which was a big signing back then. He makes his debut. But the game against Falkirk, the 2 points I'll make, the game against Falkirk, Kenny Ward played with Falkirk at that time, and although he never played in the game, he's in the squad. The replay where Falkirk beat us 1-0 in the changing room. Now, Kenny Ward's a Celtic fan. He's the guy that played with St Johnstone, he played with Falkirk, he played with Hamilton, various teams around about Scotland. And he's a fellow Fifer, and I know him, and this is where the story came from. But he said after the game, the Falkirk dressing room were singing the Cheer Up Tommy Burns song with the Sad Fenian Bastard lyric. And Tommy Burns walked in. He walked in on it, Kevin, whilst they're singing it, right? And Tommy Burns, even though he heard it and he's walked in on it, he congratulated the Falkirk players and the management team. And then he walked out, and Kenny Ward said he was embarrassed for everybody in that changing room, but it showed you the class of Tommy Burns. It showed you the class of the man that he's walked in on that scene, and instead of being disgusted or throwing the toys out the pram, he congratulated the whole lot of them for basically losing him his job, and he walks away. So I had to share that with you. I might have mentioned it before. The other one was George Cadet, and I got this from an interview with Jock Brown that I had some time ago, but unfortunately the sound quality wasn't good enough, so I've never put it out as a podcast. It's my intention to transcribe it at some point and put it out. But he went over to Portugal, obviously, pre-season after this particular season to sign or to ensure that Cadet was coming back. And Cadet agreed to come back, but there was an issue when they walked into the villa, and the issue was his partner, right? So she never even spoke to Jock Brown and his fellow board member who was with him. She walked out the back, sat and read a book, didn't even say hello. Cadet agrees to come back. By the time Brown touches down in Glasgow, got a voicemail on his phone, and Cadet's in tears telling Brown that he couldn't come over. It was all down to his partner, right? And the plan was to marry up Cadet with Larson. So you've asked a question there about the Cadet and De Canio. Can you imagine the strike force of Henrik Larsson and George Cadet? It's just, the mind boggles, the mind boggles.
When you look at the goals George Cadet scored, he was a phenomenal finisher. He had pace to burn. He was fantastic in there. The bullet headers that he used to do with the mane just flying in the wind after it. That would have been something. It really, really would have been something. Another thing about that period, and this is hindsight once again, is all of them seem to take umbrage at Andy Tom being the highest paid player at the club. And now, maybe looking back, you could say that, especially Cadet and Van Hooijdonk, maybe had a point. I like Tom as a player, but he never done as much as what, for me, he never done as much as what Van Hooijdonk and Cadet were showing in the team at the time, eh? So, maybe my stance of Cadet and Van Hooijdonk is probably softened a bit over the years, looking back. And obviously you hear the stories about Fergus, and by the way, McCann was proved right with a lot of things at that time. Being a 20-year-old, you really just want the best for your football club, and you want them to hold on to the best football players, and you really do get annoyed with the board when they do not hold on to these football players, especially when you're going the following season. We spoke about the following season in the last podcast, but you look at that summer, Jock Brown went to try and get Cadet, he doesn't come back, we didn't appoint a manager until late on in the close season. We were a shambles. Well, on the outside looking in, it looked like we were a shambles anyway. And even during that season, I mean, we're trying to stop our rivals winning 9 in a row, which could now be seen as a tainted 9 in a row with some of the revelations that have came out. But there was bonus rows in the squad. There was Van Hooijdonk getting dropped for... He got dropped for a game at Ibrox. And when Cadet was injured as well. You've got De Canio straight after Tommy's been sacked. We played Hibs on the Saturday or the Sunday. Decano scored, and he says in a live TV interview, the infamous, "I've got a little problem with my contract." And
I thought you were going to do that in an Italian accent, yeah.
I thought better of it. I was, then I changed my mind. And also, no disrespect, but having a look back at that season, we had a problem in the goalkeeping position. Gordon Marshall was terrible, and Stuart Kerr was a young laddie who possibly that season ruined his career.
And then it was a pre-season of discontent, and McStay has to retire. Peter Grant leaves shortly afterwards, and we have spoken about the Wim Jansen season and that campaign, but it was really incredible to think that we were able to turn that around and stop the 10. I know a lot of Celtic fans would rather say we won the one, but in relation also, Kevin, to other music, we'll move on to that in a wee second, that came out this year. You mentioned the Three Amigos. I can't claim that this is my story. This story came from Tom Campbell. As many of our listeners will know, Tom resides in Canada, and he decided one day that he would go and try and find Fergus McCann. He'd never interviewed him. He wanted to interview him for a book he was writing. So he went to try and find Fergus, and I think it was when he was writing the Celtic Paranoia, you know, the book that he wrote. So he goes to try and find Fergus, and he finds the actual road that leads up to the street. And at the bottom of the road, there's a pub, and the pub is called The Three Amigos. True story. So some of the other, he never got his interview with McCann. Some of the other music that came out, we've already mentioned Underworld. Now, you know, they came to a lot of people's attention through Trainspotting, but obviously they were a prolific band, but I think that probably was their biggest hit to date. We've already spoken in depth about Suede coming up. Some of the other albums that really stand out from that year for me, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Murder Ballads, gave us songs like Where the Wild Roses Grow with Kylie Minogue, but also a song called Stagger Lee. If you've never heard Stagger Lee, put it on YouTube. Unbelievable song. Were you a big Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds fan?
Can I say I was? No. As he's one artist, again, the size of his body of work probably scares me to try and jump back in at some point, eh? But I probably will one day will have a go at trying to listen to Nick Cave.
Right, well, after this recording, Kevin, go onto YouTube and just type in Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Into My Arms, listen to that. That's a good start, and you'll probably be hooked thereafter, right? And you can thank me later for that one. DJ Shadow, introducing DJ Shadow. I've got to admit, I probably listened to him retrospectively after I discovered Uncle, and then I went back to listen to DJ Shadow, who's never released a bad record. The one record in particular that he did release was Introducing, which again was just a work of absolute genius. And for anybody who's listening in who's not discovered DJ Shadow, give him a listen as well.
You mentioned the albums there, Paul, but the albums that I listened to that year constantly were The Super Furry Animals, Fuzzy Logic, The Screaming Trees, Dust, The Blue Tones, Expecting to Fly, and Underworld, Setting Toughest and The Infants.
So Screaming Trees, given that, is that a departure from your usual tastes?
I would describe them as a post-grunge American rock band. Mark Lanigan, who was a member of the Screaming Trees, has released some fantastic solo work as well. Phenomenal artist, and that was one of the albums that really surprised me. I didn't expect to like it, but it definitely came round and slapped me in the face. A phenomenal rock record.
So Super Furry Animals, again, a band that for a number of albums, I was right into the Super Furry Animals, seen them at the Barrowlands, seen them at Reading Festival, and we then watched, I think it was Primal Scream, and the band were standing right next to us as we watched Primal Scream. Talking to whom, did you see Primal Scream's tweet today?
Yes, I did. I did see the Primal Scream's tweet today.
Oh, just a wee reminder that it's going to be 9 in a row. I just thought it was tremendous. So obviously that's another band that we are very much into. And every time we go through the years, if there's a Primal Scream album, we'll talk about it, because I don't think there's been a bad one, personally, Kevin. But Super Furries, where are we now with the Super Furries then? Is it still a band that you listen to?
Definitely. I'm a big fan of the Griff's solo work as well. I love the Super Furry Animals. Last saw them at the Liverpool Festival of Psychedelia a couple of years back, the last time it was on. They were decent that night, but one of my best experiences seeing them was on the Rings Around the World tour at the Barrowlands when they had like a sort of TV screens everywhere, and they were just, and they had the quadraphonic sound as well. But that obviously Fuzzy Logic was your introduction to the Super Furries, Something for the Weekend, and that's on that album, and it's possibly their most straightforward rock record before they disappeared down the rabbit holes of psychedelia and Welsh hallucinogenics and whatever else they were up to, driving tanks about the place.
And the Blue Tones, Expecting to Fly. What was your initial thoughts on the Blue Tones?
Expecting to Fly was one of my favourite albums, and I used to have to get the bus to work. I still had a Walkman in 1996, so I had recorded Expecting to Fly on it. I did have a CD player in the house, I was doing that out of time, and I had Expecting to Fly enough, and I must have listened to it every day for about 3 or 4 months. I really loved that album. It's no one that I've revisited recently. It had that sort of, I'm going to say, shrug. It was kind of music you could shrug along to, if that sounds
shrug,
in a good way.
As in like
shrug
your
shoulders.
Shuffle. Is that a shoulder shuffle you're talking about? Right.
I didn't have a swagger. I had a shoulder shuffle. Really good guitar playing on it. Really good songs. Really good songwriter. I did see them at the Barrowlands round about that time. You mentioned DJ Shadow. At the time, a lot of my pals were into electronic music. A lot of them were aspiring DJs. So, again, I never owned the DJ Shadow album, but I did experience it, and I have got good memories of that album, but I've never owned it. I can confirm your recommendation. It's a really, really good album.
That takes us up to the end of our latest Schema Celica podcast, Kevin, where we have been speaking about 1996. We've been speaking about Celtic's deterioration in the final season under Tommy Burns, but obviously it opened the door to Wim Jansen's arrival and Celtic finally stopping the financially doped Rangers from winning 10 in a row. We've spoken about coming up with Suede and various other records around about that time, as well as the phenomenon that was Trainspotting. Kevin, get your thinking cap on for the next episode. It's been an absolute pleasure as always.
Cheers, Paul.
And I'll speak to you next week.
Network.